including, ironically, the Dartmouth crew jersey worn by the getaway canoe driver. The men were separated and questioned, with audio recordings made of each interrogation. They had no idea that their apprehension had been guided by one of the most wanted men in the world, aided by technology they didn't know existed. Rhys sat back and smiled. This was their third interdiction operation in 2 weeks, and the men were really getting the hang of it. They'd taken 13 poachers into custody and seized guns, ammo, ivory, meat, hides, and a truckload of wire snares. In this little corner of Africa, they were beginning to make a difference. Rhys shook hands with Muzi and Gona and thanked them for the great job they'd done in helping him track the poachers to their point of exfil. It was after midnight. Rhys and his team would be back at it in the morning. Without the wartime stress of preparing for and leading men into combat that had preoccupied him and the SEAL teams, Rhys's mind was clear and calm. He rose with the sun, pushed himself hard all day, and slept soundly at night. He'd found peace here in the primal rhythm of the wild. He had a mission, an enemy, and was part of a team he trusted. He had purpose. His sun-streaked hair hung to his shoulders and his beard nearly touched his chest. His skin was burned to a shade of walnut from his time at sea and from the relentless African sun. The simple but nutritious diet of game meat and vegetables, coupled with the nearly constant physical activity, had made his body lean and hard. The chiseled separation between his muscles was visible, as were the thick veins on his arms. His body fat hadn't been this low since he'd completed BUDS nearly 2 decades earlier. He wore khaki shorts and an olive-green cotton safari-style shirt with the RH Safaris logo embroidered above his chest pocket. His boots were locally made buffalo hide veldskon, and he wore a wide-brimmed slouch hat. The old 404 rifle had become a trusted friend that was never more than an arm's length away, and he wore its thick cartridges on his belt, like a gunfighter. He looked far less like a fugitive naval officer from California and more like an African-born professional hunter. After 2 months of anti-poaching operations, Rhys and his team had taken a serious toll on the opposition. They'd arrested 3 dozen men, both local bushmeat poachers as well as those working under professional poaching syndicates, burned numerous camps, and seized 3 pickup truck loads of wire snares. Word had gotten out that this was no longer a good place to be if you weren't respecting the game laws. Rich was confident that they would see game numbers rise sharply in the concession as a result. With the change in season, hunters from the United States and Europe had begun to arrive, and the PHs shifted their focus to the day-to-day operations of the safaris, while Rhys continued to scout for poaching activity. The bush pilot who brought the hunters into and out of the camp's airstrip would sit idly in camp during safaris, keeping the plane ready in case of a medical emergency that would require an air evacuation. He was bored to death waiting for the call that never came, so Rhys put him to work. For major operations, he became the drone pilot and Rhys became the ground force commander for the game scouts. The anti-poaching force was competent and capable, and Rhys provided tactical leadership while staying in the shadows. All the poachers knew was that the game scouts had gotten really good at their jobs. None were aware of the trained commando leader quietly pulling the strings. Chapter 28. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa. May. Flat tires were an everyday occurrence, so common that Rhys and his 2 trackers acted like a NASCAR pit crew as soon as they felt the tire go. The Land Cruiser pickup carried 2 spares mounted on each side of the tubular safari rack above the truck's bed, and they were about to use the 2nd spare of the day. Rhys glanced at his watch and gave both men the go. They seemed to understand far more English than they spoke, and though they'd probably never seen an auto race, They quickly caught on to the fact that Rhys had turned this mundane exercise into a game. Rhys retrieved the high-lift farm jack from the front bumper while Solomon loosened the lug nuts on the flat and Gona wrestled the spare wheel down from the rack. Rhys got the jack in place on top of a flat rock and began pumping the wounded pickup skyward. The tire had barely cleared the ground when the flat was removed and the fresh wheel was mounted. The three men labored swiftly and without words, teamwork born of several months working together closely in this remote wilderness. Rhys lowered the jack and the tire hit the ground, calling out the time. 2:45, a new record! Both trackers beamed as they all shook hands. Their celebration was broken by the sound of gunfire, a three-round burst that, to Rhys, had the unmistakable report of an AKM. The only AKs in the block belonged to the government game scouts who accompanied the hunting parties, and they would be dozens of miles from Reese's location, according to their last radio call. The shots could have come from only one source: poachers. Rhys reached into the rack behind the cab of the pickup and slid his rifle out of the soft, zippered case that protected it from the elements. He retracted the bolt slightly and confirmed that a round was in the chamber before closing the bolt and checking the safety. He opened the flap on his leather belt pouch and was satisfied to see the five massive brass cartridges gleaming in the East African sunlight. He took the Motorola two-way radio from his belt and attempted to call back to base camp.
Base, this is James. Over.
Base, this is James. Do you read me?
No response, just static.
Shit!
Base, this is James. If you can hear me, we've got full auto gunfire just south of the Lugenda River near the boulders. Moving to take a look.
Rhys turned down the volume on his radio and took a deep breath. He nodded to his trackers and pointed toward the sound of the shots. Without hesitation, all three men moved at a light jog down the red dirt track. Even after working with them for months, Rhys was constantly in awe of their tracking skills. Not only could they follow a track over hard ground, they could often do it at a running pace. Solomon's finger pointed toward the ground, and he took a left turn into the Miombo forest. As they entered the bush, they slowed to a walking pace and moved as stealthily as possible. No words were spoken. Rhys could read the men's body language at this point, and hand signals would cover any needed communication. They moved in single file down a narrow game path, Solomon in the lead, Gona behind him, and Rhys taking up the rear. They worked just as they had when scouting game animals for their outfitter. Each man had specific responsibilities. Solomon was the point man who led the way and kept an eye out for any sign on the ground. His eyes were primarily directed downward. Gona kept his head up and searched for any visual sign of life, animal or human. Rhys supervised the tracking, provided cover, handled communications with their base camp, and made the command decisions when necessary. It was just like the old days back in the teams. Solomon slowed the pace and all three men crouched as they walked to lower their profile. He stopped and squatted at the edge of a clearing, and Rhys moved up quietly to kneel beside him. The tracker nodded toward the source of the gunfire. Four poachers, two of them armed with AKs and the other two with small axes. All four were surrounding the blood-soaked carcass of an elephant on its side, a cow from the looks of it. The men were close to 80 yards away, too far away to hear any voices, but their body language told the tale. One of the men wielding a rifle was motioning toward the axemen, letting them know how he wanted the ivory cut loose. Rhys's plan was to observe the crime and keep track of the poachers while he worked to gain radio contact and wait for the game scouts. Getting into a gunfight in a third world country as a wanted man was not part of the plan. Rhys retrieved a small digital camera from the pocket of his shorts and extended the optical zoom as far as possible. He was too far away to get any good facial shots, but any photos would be better than nothing when it came to building a criminal case. He took a few pictures and was putting the camera back in his pocket when he heard a crashing sound to his left. He turned in time to see a gray blur coming toward them along with a loud screaming sound. Calf.
The dead cow obviously had a young calf, and the little guy was doing his best to avenge his mother's death. The calf, which easily weighed 500 pounds, was heading directly for Gona. The three men scattered to avoid the charging animal, their movement catching the attention of the poachers. Gunfire erupted across the clearing, and Rhys heard the unmistakable crack of high-velocity rifle rounds passing just over his head. "Get down!" he yelled, diving to the ground and flipping the safety catch on his 404 to fire. Lying on his side, he put the silver sight bead on the closest poacher and pressed the trigger without conscious thought. The big bullet found its mark with an audible slap, and Rhys rolled to his right while working the bolt to reload. He made his way to his feet and, in a crouch, ran to his right to flank the remaining gunman, who he could still hear firing in long bursts. Taking cover 6 feet behind the trunk of a large tree, Rhys worked to get a visual angle on his next target. He saw a lone figure kneeling near the elephant's head, struggling to change magazines on his rifle. Rhys dropped down to one knee, took an extra second to be sure of his aim, and sent a 400-grain solid through the man's chest. The man dropped instantly, his rifle and magazine falling into the dust in front of him. Rhys saw no sign of the two men armed with axes, but could see both AKs on the ground, so he was reasonably sure that they hadn't armed themselves to mount a counterattack. Head count, he thought, racing back toward where he'd last seen his trackers. His heart sank when he saw Gona leaning over Solomon, who was covered in blood. Rhys unzipped the wounded man's olive jumpsuit and quickly identified two bullet wounds, one to the upper chest and one to the abdomen. He gently rolled him over and determined that there was an exit wound on his back from the chest wound, but not one from the abdominal hit. Solomon was conscious, but obviously struggling to breathe. "Gona, run back to the truck and get the aid kit. The red bag. Hurry!" Gona took off at a dead run toward the truck as Rhys tried to calm his wounded friend. "You're going to be fine, buddy. We'll get you to a doctor." Rhys grabbed the Motorola and turned the volume up before keying the mic. "Base, this is James. Over." Nothing. "Base, this is James. Solomon has been shot. I say again, Solomon has been shot. Over." No response. "Breathe, buddy. Relax and breathe." Solomon's eyes were wide as he struggled for breath. Rhys knew that he needed to get the wound sealed up fast. On a deployment, he would have had the tools to provide immediate aid with a blowout kit secured to his gear, but here, he had to wait for Gona to return with the bag, wasting precious seconds. Rifle in hand, Rhys rose to a squat to peek above the low brush where Solomon was lying and confirmed that the clearing was still devoid of life. He heard movement behind him and spun his muzzle around to see Gona sprinting through the brush with the aid bag, dropping it at Rhys's feet. Rhys handed him the rifle. Gona couldn't drive, but he was good with a gun. Without saying a word, the man took off at a jog, skirting the woods on the right side of the clearing to locate the two surviving poachers. "Stay with me, Solomon. This is going to help you breathe." Rhys unzipped the aid bag and dug around until he found an Asherman chest seal. He wiped Solomon's chest with a gauze pad before tearing open the package and placing the adhesive seal on his chest. He rolled his tracker and repeated the process on the exit wound. Rhys found a 2.5-inch needle and laid it on top of the Asherman on Solomon's chest. Then, locating a spot above the wound between the first and second rib, Rhys held his left finger on the spot and, with the needle held in his right fist, stabbed it into the chest cavity. He heard a hissing sound and watched with relief as Solomon was able to take a breath. When the hissing stopped, he removed the needle and laid it back on the bandage. The breathing situation handled for now, Rhys searched the bag until he found a large dressing. There was a small section of bowel herniating out of the abdominal wound that needed to be addressed. Rhys used his fingers to spread the wound and moved the abdomen from side to side as he gently eased the exposed intestine back inside. The wound wasn't bleeding much, so Rhys was hopeful that the bullet hadn't hit the liver. He covered it with the large dressing and wrapped the attached ace-style bandage around Solomon's body until the dressing was secure. "How's your breathing?" Rhys asked.
"Water. Shamwari. I must have water."
Rhys knew that putting fluid into the man's body could blow out any clots that were forming on his abdominal wound. "I can't give you water right now. We've got to get you to a hospital." Rhys tried the radio again without success. "Damn it!" The closest medical facility was the clinic at Montepuez. They were 2 hours from the clinic and 2 hours from the airstrip at base camp. With solid comms, Rhys could call back to the camp manager and have a Mars flight on its way to meet them, but as it was, he couldn't be certain that taking Solomon back to base wouldn't add hours before treatment. Rhys speculated that Solomon would survive the 2-hour ride to the hospital, but he wasn't sure that he'd survive waiting around for a plane that might take all day to arrive. With Gona unable to drive, Rhys would have to deliver him to the hospital, which meant he'd be seen. Gunshot wounds meant police, and police meant questions. Still, there wasn't even a choice. Solomon was a good man. They'd become teammates, and Rhys wasn't going to let one of his men die to protect his cover. He whistled to Gona, and they prepared Solomon for travel. Chapter 29. Blowing through small villages and towns with Solomon slowly bleeding out in the back of the Land Cruiser, Rhys did his best to avoid major bumps that would cause his wounded teammate any additional suffering, but he was also more than aware of the golden hour and that time waits for no one, least of all someone with a gunshot wound to the chest. Rhys sped around women carrying goods on their heads, boys in donkey carts made from old cars and pickup trucks, and the occasional automobile. He certainly wasn't winning any hearts and minds. He didn't dwell on the men he'd just killed in the African bush. He was back in operator mode, doing what he did best. He was protecting his team, and to Rhys, that was as natural as breathing. No more than a gas station with a few small stores, the tiny enclave of Montepuez was also home to a small medical clinic. It was located adjacent to an old Portuguese mission, the stone walls still dotted with bullet strikes from the Civil War decades earlier. Rhys pulled the cruiser to a stop in front of the building and sprinted through the front doors. A queue of locals, mostly elderly men and women, and mothers holding their children, waited in the room that served as the lobby. Rushing past the line and ignoring the young female aid worker who tried to block his path, he ran through a hallway that opened into a large room filled with 2 dozen mosquito-netted cots, where a tall white man in scrubs with a stethoscope was attending to a patient. "Are you the doctor? I need your help right now." The man turned and faced him, unfazed by his sense of urgency. "You'll have to wait your turn, sir," he said with an obvious British accent. "There are a great number of people here that need our help. I have a critical patient. Gunshot wound to the chest, he's bleeding out in the back of my truck." The doctor's demeanor shifted instantly. "Drop everything and let's get this man in here right now," he ordered his staffers. Rhys led the way back out front as the doctor and 4 other individuals in scrubs followed him, carrying an old-fashioned canvas stretcher. They placed the stretcher on the open tailgate and eased Solomon onto it, Gona looking over their shoulders like a worried father. Rhys kept pace with the physician as they made their way back inside. "He's got a 7.62 round through the chest that exited and a 2nd round to the abdomen that's still in there. I put an Asherman on his chest and dressed the abdominal wound. The bowel was herniated, so I tucked it back in. He hasn't had any fluids." "How long ago was he shot?" Rhys glanced at the watch on his wrist. "Just over 2 hours ago." "You've done well. Now I need you to step aside while we get him ready for surgery." The medical team carried Solomon into a smaller room where they placed him on a table and began to examine him. Someone closed a curtain to block Rhys's view, signaling it was time to let the professionals take over. Leaving the clinic, Rhys looked up at Gona, staring down at him from the truck's bed. "I think he's going to make it. We got him here in time." Gona nodded and sat down on the tailgate. Rhys sat next to him, waiting in silence. Rhys was asleep in the bed of the truck, his legs dangling from the tailgate, when he felt someone grab his leg.
"Sir? Excuse me, sir? Your friend. Your friend is going to survive."
"Huh?" Rhys bolted upright and found the